Community Movement Builders is a collective of Black people building sustainable, self-determining communities through cooperative economic platforms and collective community organizing. I have with me today the founder of Community Movement Builder, Kamal Franklin.
Nice to see you.
And one of the members and organizers within Community Movement Builders, Zahir Netcher.
Peace, peace.
And first, just kind of give me a background on each of you, what you do with the group, what your overall purpose, mission, objective is.
The group was founded about 4 or 5 years ago by myself and some young students, youth in the neighborhood. At first, it was founded to be more of a youth organization, and then little by little, we started seeing or taking in the conditions of the neighborhood and some of the things that were happening, and decided to move towards being a community organizing group that was interested in sustainable development. And so since that time, we've started a number of programs. We have a community house that hosts a childcare center, that hosts another community-based organization that has an urban farmer living here. We are the caretakers of a community garden that's right next door to the house we have. We also have an aquaponics center. We're starting a kale chip cooperative. We do organizing against gentrification. We do political education. We're starting a trucking and a security cooperative. So there's a whole bunch of things that we're trying to do with the small resources that we have to commit ourselves to development, which is helpful for this neighborhood, and to organize to make sure long-term residents stay in place.
My name is Zahir. I do the political education and community movement builders. I'm also one of the organizers and the number of things that we're doing, including the security group that we're starting. Me personally, I'm still kind of new to organizing, but I've been dedicated to the liberation of new African peoples.
Speaking of resources and organizing, what is the importance of resources, obviously, when organizing, and how real can you keep it when you are so based on available resources?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think resources obviously become extremely important when you want to build out something bigger than a prototype. So it's hard to do this kind of work without trying to capture donations from either foundations or individuals, or even trying to develop cooperatives or micro businesses that can help sustain your work. So there's no getting around the need of having resources, i.e. money, to build out programs as model projects that can help sustain your community. The problem is that most of the time, organizations like ours, you know, we may have political ideas, rhetoric, things that we want to do, but because of the conditions of our folks in this country, we don't have access usually to a lot of resources, and that means that we have to rely sometimes on grants and foundations and individual donors. So the problem being is that some of the system, the nonprofit system, or sometimes called the nonprofit industrial complex, is set up so that folks in our position have to rely on those institutions, and those institutions start to make decisions around the character of your work, what your work can say and cannot say, the type of work that you do, i.e. mostly policy work, and how that directs folks back into a two-party electoral system. And it sours on anybody who's talking about making radical change that brings people outside the system of U.S., let's say, monopoly capitalism, electoral politics, but something that talks about doing something that's either socialist, cooperative, that Black people are talking about self-determination. Those things are frowned upon and not well-funded, and so there's always a hurdle with that.
Speaking of, you brought up, what is the difference, and how do you battle with the difference between liberal and radical organizing?
I think liberal organizing, which even people who think they are radical engage in liberal organizing, it keeps you tied to both the Democratic and Republican parties. It thinks all issues can be solved through policy adjustments in U.S. in the U.S. electoral and political system. And the problem with that is that the very same political system that was set up to oppress, harass, depress, keep folks poor is not going to be able to solve the problems that it has caused itself. So radical organizing, which starts to think about how do we create liberated territory How do we sustain ourselves outside of the system? Not that policy work isn't important, but when it's overvalued as opposed to getting resources and creating institutions that we can run and control ourselves, that's when the problem lies. And I think liberals will always tell you what the problem is, and sometimes they're dead on some of what the problems are, but the solutions are always more policy, more legislative action, more people getting elected of different stripes, and hardly ever does it break out of that system and trying to figure out how do we get to control the institutions that have control over our lives.
Speaking of where you had spoken about controlling your own rhetoric, I assume, Zaire, that is the thread that you, where you weave in with the political education, being able to control the narrative, build up what you're thinking. So express a little bit more about that.
Well, controlling the narrative, it's very important. Propaganda is essential to any type of organization. Any little thing from Facebook to Instagram to even forming up protests out there, just any way to get your name out and to try to change the narrative from the public perception. The problem is, once we start talking about funds, we lack some of the access that I guess the liberals do, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they could go on CNN or MSNBC or something, and they can put one narrative out there and you'll have entire communities wrapped around these certain ideals. And that's very frustrating as an organizer, because you're sitting here thinking, are we really talking about this subject again? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. something, the same old story every couple of years gets regurgitated. And then when you want to take real action, you know, if you say, we got to get to the roots of the problem, you have to sit here and define exactly what the problem is to the masses of the people. That's what really becomes, that's why I say political education is probably most essential to any organization. But I think it's something that doesn't get done in a lot of organizations.
I'll add on that I think that the apparatus these days is so strong that folks who are liberal or who think they'll use radical language, even radicals will use radical language and divorce it from radical action to favor themselves with larger foundations, but to make themselves look like they're the leading edge of change. And that leaves folks who really are trying to do this work in a way that's not, again, beholden to the U.S. system, left out in the cold of those resources. And it makes sense, right? Because they want to control, like you said, the narrative, and anything that shifts that away is a danger to keeping the system going.
Right.
Well, that leads me to another point when you said that possibly misuse of radical language makes you seem as if you're in the forefront even when you're doing other things for other reasons. How do you combat those situations where the media runs to those that are very comfortable with the status quo versus running to those that are really the grassroots, the boots in the streets for the Black community? How do you combat, like you said, with the CNN, the MSNBC, which can propel a large a narrative that may not be necessarily what's true is going on in the
basically is, I mean, is it okay to call out people like frauds or something?
I think you can.
I mean, because when you see some, like Al Sharpton, for example, like we call them ambulance chasers. Mm-hmm. every time an event happens, you see the same people in the same voices. So I mean, I think a big part of that is calling people out when you see the contradiction, expose the contradictions. That's one way to go forward and struggle.
And I think some of the things that you are involved in is creating our own media, right? How do we create scenarios and situations, which we have options these days because of the advent of social media, and obviously that has some positives and negatives, but the advent of social media allows us to create other ways to reach our people, which is not as beholden as in the past on sort of corporate media institutions. So, of course, there's other problems with that, how you can reach people with the work that you can actually do, the too much time on social media and not enough time in actual communities doing work. But I think you're right, it's through sort of checking folks, creating other media opportunities, other ways to get your voice out there, and then hoping that enough people see it so that they start getting pulled towards the work that you're doing.
This is a good time for that, because we got podcasts we could do. Facebook, like we said earlier, social media accounts. It's not so dependent on corporate media like it was, where you have to go to radio stations or try to get, you know, certain ideas stamped, have a stamp of approval. Mm-hmm. But we have our own independent outlet, so I think that's an important route in there.
Well, how effective, or which is more effective in your opinion, based on experience and, you know, continuing to gain knowledge, liberal organizing or radical organizing, or are they pretty much not exclusive of each other?
I mean, I think there's a lot of overlap, whether or not folks who are radical like to admit it, right? There's overlap between the work of policy reform with both radical and liberal organizing. But again, it's hard to defeat something that has not only money resources, but media outlets, in other ways in which you can reach the sort of multitude of folks, where we have a limited scope of folks that we can reach. So I think for us, for folks like us who consider ourselves to be sort of radical organizers, it's about building up our platforms, our institutions, our organizations, so that we are we can't be ignored, right? And I think that's one of the most important things that organizations like Community Movement Builders and others can do. If you have a radical line, you have to take the time to build up your own, let's say, cachet, so that folks can't ignore you and that you don't have to rely on some of these outside groups with their institutional resources and their media apparatuses to put you back in touch with your people. And it's not like it hasn't been done before. Marcus Garvey didn't rely on, the UNIA did not rely on mass media. The Nation of Islam did not rely on mass media to get into the community. To an extent, the Panthers didn't rely on, at first, mass media to get larger and bigger into the community. Organizations like SNCC and so forth. So it's not like those examples are not out there. It's just that people are sort of overcome with so much media that it's all that noise you got to break through.
Yeah, I think the material conditions really should justify any action, right? So what goes on in the politics of Atlanta? What goes on in the politics of Jackson, Mississippi? What's the politics going on in Brazil or Africa? All of the material conditions is going to dictate more so the path that you need to take. It's not so much, you shouldn't rely too much on theory. It's theory and practice. Mm-hmm. And these two play with each other. So you can't necessarily just take the role of, we're not going to participate in any electoral politics, us being so radical, we don't need to vote. Meanwhile, you have like Nazi skinheads running for office. And that makes you participate in the political system whether you like it or not. Because if they come out with a rule like they did recently, like, you know, they can say, we don't want you to wear your dreadlocks. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, you're being excluded and you're being discriminated against through an electoral political system anyway. So we have to take any means necessary approach to politics given the framework of the material conditions. Word.
One question, actually two parts for both of you. First, Kamal, how hard is it to organize now compared to when you first began? And then Zaire, secondly, what is your new influx of information and, I guess, injection into how organizing is now with a new millennium?
Well, now that I am an old man, you know, and I've been organizing since, like, I would say the late to mid 80s and 90s. I think some of the differences, we talked a little bit about social media, which again has its positives and its negatives, right? But it is a communication tool. But I think one thing I will say about in the past is that I knew all the organizers and what they did and did not do, right? Whether or not that was in New York and some other places where I'm from, you knew who were the organizers, who were the talkers, who were the pretenders, who showed up at the end of the rally and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I think these days you don't even have to show up at a rally. You can create an interface through online activity that people buy into, and they start feeling like that person has answers, or that person has been in the trenches, or that person knows what they're talking about through their experiences, and really all they're doing is preparing speeches and talking on camera. And they've never been out in the community, they haven't organized anything for anyone. And any checks you send those folks will go into their pocket. So I think that's one huge difference that I see, is that people now see another turnaround time. You can actually be a media star or a professional organizer in a lot of ways. And I don't think those opportunities, or the, whether I call them opportunities or not, but opportunists, were as prevalent in the 90s and so forth, particularly amongst folks who were like doing organizing in the streets. I think that's a huge change, something that's in general more detrimental to truly getting some change done, because you have a lot of folks, again, with large platforms who've never in their life, whether it's policy or institution building or any kind of organizing, done any of that kind of work.
I see, the big difference I see is that there's a big change in the perception about being a poor righteous revolutionary, you know, a poor righteous teacher, because now it's like I see people charging more so, anything from classes to movies. And I think from a lot of lectures I watch, a lot when they describe the 60s era, everything had a big emphasis on being free. And so nowadays it seems like the big emphasis is on, why does it need to be free? I need to get paid this money. I think personally that comes from a lot of the 80s era, where they kind of pushed out individualism and this new look on entrepreneurship. And so everything comes with this sort of price now. It's not in it for the material good or the use value. Everything is done on the basis of an exchange value. And like he said, I think that takes away from the authenticity of what we're doing. We can't necessarily think in those terms, because once we put a price limit on every interaction that we have, then we allow this concept of us depersonalizing with each other, separating ourselves, where we only see each other in terms of a market exchange, and not necessarily seeing the value of communion, community, bringing ourselves together, and really addressing these problems. That was one of the biggest things I've seen. Another thing I saw was, it seems like when I really first started going into these organizations, I felt like I saw the impact of COINTELPRO, because I would see people who are 70 and then people who are 20 in one organization. And I saw that there was no there's no in between, because the era was erased, you know, for a lot of organizations. And so I think what ends up happening is you got the elders who are like, this is how we do it, this is how it needs to be done. And then you got this separate group of super young people who may not know everything that they've been through, but they have ideas in their head, and sometimes they clash.
Yeah. I mean, in addition to that, I would think something that my generation benefited from also was that we got to talk directly to Panthers, SNCC, SCLC people, who were only at that point maybe 20 to 25 years removed from the organizing that was the most prominent organizing of our day in the late 60s and early 70s. And I think this newer generation, some of those folks are still around, but they're much older. And I think you're right, there hasn't that in-between generation of maybe folks my age who are around enough, are not there to say, like, not exclusively this is the right or wrong way to do things, but these are some of the teeth lessons that were taught to us that we can pass on. Instead, people do have that in between of, like, it's all about the media, or it's all about that's the new teacher. Right. Yeah. It's not like those lessons that were passed down directly, exclusively from folks that you met who were part of the Black Panther Party or part of the BLA or part of RAM, you know, some of the other groups from the 1960s and 70s.
And so a problem that arises is, I see, like I said earlier, individualism comes out. And so now you have a bunch of people who may have read a couple books, and now they're like, you know what? I'm that guy. So now a new Panther Party gets made. a new organization comes up, and everybody's these lone wolves, individualists that want to be the main star of their group. And it just leads to a lot of clashings. And, you know, of course, the elders are still there, and they say, well, you're not really, you don't have the blessings to call yourself this. Your ideology is off. But to them, it's like, I justify it myself.
So with that middle group that you were talking about, that kind of has disappeared or is less active or less involved. Why do you think they disappeared? Do you think it was more of a generation where they were finally allowed in a game they weren't allowed to play in for so long that they just, you know, were able to go get jobs, corporate jobs, and it became more about making money for a family, which then separated them from the collective?
Yeah, I still think there's that. I mean, I think the my generation of organizers, even right before this generation, and again, like 60s and 70s, this is based on the history of radical organizing being taken over by sort of a nonprofit industrial complex. And I think my generation of organizers, whether they like it or not, really exploited that to the hilt, right? And so it became a careerism thing, even more so than it was in the 60s and 70s. By the time I think when I got politicized, I didn't realize you can get paid to do work organizing. And it's probably like, you know, maybe within that stream of doing that work over a few years, that all of a sudden were people who were building large organizing institutions that should have been good in organized organizations. And you were sort of happy sometimes that people were well resourced, but it didn't turn into something that then you could see that work in the street. So you could see how that shifted a neighborhood or a community. Instead, you could see how it gave somebody a six-figure salary job, and they got speaking gigs and they did tours, but you didn't see the impact on the community. But then it became that hustle for, look, we got a $2 million budget. We got to keep that going. I got to get more grants. Right. I got to do more speaking tours. I got to do some more showy things that are not sustainable or long-term because I got to continue to bring these resources. And I think those folks have helped create that path that now this younger generation, not everybody, not intentionally for a lot of folks, but still now it feels like to me, whether purposeful or not, there's a bigger fight for resources and attention than there is for practical outcomes and what the work product is.
With saying that, can you explain the nonprofit
industrial complex?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's based on the ideas of like the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, starting to fund the civil rights movement in the later 60s. Particularly, you have a famous story that Malcolm talked about, like the March on Washington, where the Big Six, as they were called, NAACP, SNCC, CORE, several other groups, were offered hundreds of thousands of dollars from, I think, the Rockefeller or Ford Foundation, I can't remember which one, if they had the March on Washington in a certain way. So they had to come at a certain time, leave at a certain time, change their speeches, make sure that the march was geared towards a policy fight around civil rights legislation. Everybody agreed with that deal. That was a deal struck with the president at the time, Kennedy, again with the civil rights organizations and with foundations. And post that, I think, particularly with the Ford Foundation, I think black capitalism or capitalism in black America, I think a Robert Allen book, I can't remember the name, really emphasized how the foundations started to give money out to these organizations to do programs. Something we joke about, me and Zaire, about the idea of like poverty pimps. Folks who say they're doing community work, they're doing organizing, but they're getting checks, and that organizing is not sustained. Right. I think that boat has now turned into an ocean liner for today, where folks think about a career in nonprofit organizing, even if at their most radical. And again, these things turned into conferences, they turned into seminars, they turned into trainings, but they don't turn into, I'm in this community, I'm developing myself in this community, and this is a long-term project at work, I'm not just bringing together activists and organizers, I'm working with people in the community. So I think a role model that we need to get back to, not only the Panthers, which I think is the most obvious kind of radical vision that we all talk about, but the SNCC model of moving into communities, working with people, developing freedom schools, doing political education, doing policy reform, starting electoral institutions, doing grassroots organizing, building cooperatives. Those models are not being duplicated to the degree necessary that I think will make real changes for our community. Instead, again, those changes are happening in that these organizers are now getting huge salaries, media attention, and that's different from organizing in a community.
So I guess that leads to the
Black Awakening in Capitalist America, Robert Oliver.
So you're talking about the commercialization of the movement. So, because you see now when people write out their title, it'll say Kamel Franklin, rapper / activist. So is activism fake and phony in this?
A lot of it is.
A lot of it is.
It's a title now. It's a career. It's a social media hit. It's a way to get you get advertisers for being an activist these days. What's the kid with the vest, and he got a contract from Twitter or whatever, but he became big in doing the Ferguson work. But it's that kind of thing. It's like he staged arrests. So it's like these stage arrests where you know you're going to get arrested. You bend down, you take the arrest, you get out 3 hours later, and you are good with yours. So I mean, I think that kind of example is now being set. So now it's a career. It's not necessarily I'm committing myself to the movement politics, which means changing the political, organizational, institutional dynamics of what's happening in with my people and with my communities.
Yeah, I mean it's I've seen it all the time, right? We went out on a walk in a park, right, and we saw this woman, and she's dressed in all green. And she's taking a picture of herself in front of a tree. And it's creating this background that she's just this living in nature, living in the, you know, outdoors. And she's reconnecting with this past, this, you know. And it's like, well, you're at a state park. You know what I mean? And it's creating the illusion. And people like to feed into the matrix,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And it reflects, you know, obviously capitalism, right? This wealth accumulation and... this individualism, like I was saying, that's coming out. And wanting to make that dollar is the sole motivation. And it's and you could see it, right? Like you said, seminars. Like, let's teach you how to, you know, hold a sign up properly. Mm-hmm. Let me show you how to really make this. Make sure you pay a $500 fee to come in here and do this with us. Mm-hmm. You know, it gets real commercial. Like, and at the end of the day, what ends up happening is people, I think sometimes some people are kind of bitter. Maybe they were activists and they felt like I was really down, but nobody came to our classes.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody supported us. Nobody bought my t-shirt, you know. And so they, if Fox wants to pay me $1,000 to go debate on there, I might do that. And then it turned into a career. So,
you reminded me that, like, I saw recently, like, some dude on Twitter, they went to some city council meeting,
yeah,
and they filmed themselves just screaming and knocking a chair over and then walking out. So that was them protesting the city council meeting.
Right.
But they
right.
made sure that they filmed themselves individually. They didn't organize anybody else to come with them.
Yeah.
They didn't organize anybody from the community.
Right.
But they showed themselves and people's faces on the behind looking like, what the hell is going on? And then they put it up and they get like 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 hits on that. And that's now considered some form of organizing.
Right. It's that illusion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, anything, any last final thoughts? Input, data, jokes, comedy?
I mean, I always say that I just think that, I mean, I think we need to have more of these discussions. I think we need to figure out ways to broaden these and bring people back into the fold. Folks who I think, there's folks who I respect who are now large, well-known organizers. And some folks who I don't respect who are now large, well-known organizers.
Right.
But you know, I think the idea is not necessarily strictly chastisement of folks who are now blowing up, right? I think the idea is, even if you are in that position, what can you do to make sure that those resources are going back into your community like the way you thought that you wanted to do 10, 15 years before you blew up? So, I mean, I challenge those folks, I challenge all of us to sort of continue to figure out if we're really about organizing, if we're really about radical change, we got to sit together and figure out how do we get this work done, as opposed to just figuring out how do we increase our profile and our paychecks.
Right. And I say the same thing, you know, how do we keep the integrity of the movements dealing with the circumstances that we have as far as, you know, we may be poor, we may not have the amount of resources that somebody else does, and here comes, you know, big capitalism coming in and offering this kind of money, you know. And is it even ethical to take a donation mm-hmm. from somebody as long as you're putting it towards a good cause, right? Like, if you're getting offered from George Soros or something, mm-hmm. is it ethical or is it unethical to take that money as long as you know you're keeping the integrity of the organization? And those are all have to be determined by the rules, the laws, and the ideology of each organization. But I would just emphasize on determining what those values are, determining what the methods are of keeping the integrity for any organization.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. And make sure that you check us out on the website, communitymovementbuilders.org. We are also on Facebook, Instagram, a podcast on Spotify, iTunes. If you have any ideas or things you'd like to discuss, please let us know.
You're going to edit that part.
Yeah.
That was actually good. You feel like that was good?